काशी पातशाली श्री गौर भक्त वृंद की जय।
सामवेद भक्त वृंद की जय। गौर प्रेमानंद ऑल ग्लोरीज टू द असेंबल्ड डिवोटीज, ऑल ग्लोरीज टू द असेंबल्ड डिवोटीज, ऑल ग्लोरीज टू द लोटस फीट ऑफ श्री श्री गुरु एंड गौरांग। ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। We are reading in Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 4, Chapter 26. King Paranjana goes to the forest to hunt. This forest is a forest of material enjoyment. So, text number 9 this morning. Tatra Nirbinda Gatranam Chitra Vajai Shili Mukai Viplavo Abhut Dukitanam Dusaha Karunatmanam Gatra Nirbinda Gatranam Chitravajai Shili Mukai Viplavo Bhut Dukitanam Dutsaha Karunatmanam Tatra Nirbinda Gatranam Chitravajai Shili Mukai Viplavo Bhut Dukitanam Dutsaha Karunatmanam Tatra Nirbinda Gatranam Chitravajai Shili Mukai Viplavo Bhut Dukitanam Dusaha Karunatmanam
there. Nirbinaha
speaking. Nirvana, being pierced. Gatranam, whose bodies. Chitravajai, with variegated feathers. Arrows with feathers of different colors. Chili Mukai, by the arrows. Viplavaha, destruction. Abhut, was done. Dukitanam, of the most aggrieved. Dusaha, unbearable. Karuna Atmanam, for persons who are very merciful. Translation: when King Puranjana was hunting in this way, many animals within the forest lost their lives with great pain, being pierced by the sharp arrowheads. Upon seeing these devastating, ghastly activities performed by the king, all the people who were merciful by nature became very unhappy. Such merciful persons could not tolerate seeing all this killing. Srila Prabhupada's report. When demoniac persons engage in animal killing, the demigods, or devotees of the Lord, are very much afflicted by this killing. Demoniac civilizations in this modern age maintain various types of slaughterhouses all over the world. Rascal swamis and yogis encourage foolish persons to go on eating flesh and killing animals, and at the same time continue their so-called meditation and mystical practices. All these affairs are ghastly, and a compassionate person, namely a devotee of the Lord, becomes very unhappy to see such a sight. The hunting process is also carried on in a different way, as we have already explained. Hunting women, drinking different types of liquor, becoming intoxicated, killing animals, and enjoying sex all serve as the basis of modern civilization. Vaishnavas are unhappy to see such a situation in the world, and therefore they are very busy spreading this Krishna consciousness movement. The devotees are pained to see the hunting and killing of animals in the forest. The wholesale slaughter of animals in the slaughterhouses and the exploitation of young girls in brothels that function under different names as clubs and societies. Being very much compassionate upon the killing of animals in sacrifice, the great sage Narada began his instructions to King Prachinibharishit. In these instructions, Narada Muni explained that devotees like him are very much afflicted by all the killing that goes on in human society. Not only are saintly persons afflicted by this killing, but even God himself is afflicted, and therefore comes down in the incarnation of Lord Buddha. Jayadeva Goswami therefore sings, Sadaya Hridaya Darshita Pashughatam. Simply to stop the killing of animals, Lord Buddha compassionately appeared. Some rascals put forward the theory that an animal has no soul, or is something like dead stone. In this way, they rationalize that there is no sin in animal killing. Actually, animals are not dead stone. But the killers of animals are stone-hearted. Consequently, no reason or philosophy appeals to them. They continue keeping slaughterhouses and killing animals in the forest. The conclusion is that one who does not care for the instructions of sainted persons like Narada and his disciplic succession surely falls into the category of Nashta Prajna and thus goes to hell. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prestaya Bhutale Shrimate Bhakti Vedanta Swaminiti Namane Namaste Sarasvate Deve Gauravani Pacharani Nirvishesha Sunyavadi Paschacha De Satarani Om Vajnanam Timodan Dasya Gananjana Shalakaya Chaksur Militum Jainum Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Vanshakalpatrupyascha kripa sindubhyeva cha patitannam bhavanebhyo vaishnavebhyo namo namaha. This whole story about King Paranjana is an allegory, a symbolic story, told by Narada Muni to King Prachini Bhartisha. And as Prabhupada has mentioned, it began with the fact that King Prachini Barhishat was killing many animals. Even though it was in sacrifice, still he was aggrieved to see this animal killing and saw that the king was actually completely entangled in material existence. And so he told him the story about this King Paranjana, who is the living entity, who lives in the city of nine gates and so on. This whole symbolic story is there. So now they've come to this business of animal killing. King Paranjana goes in the forest to hunt. So the forest is called, what is the name, Punch or something? He went to hunt in this forest called Panchaprastha, the place of five meeting. The objects of the five senses, the object of the sense. The horse has five, the chariot he's in has five horses, so those are the five knowledge-acquiring senses, and so the forest is the place with the objects of those senses. So that's why, as Prabhupada said, that there's different ways of the hunting means different things. One of them is just the animal killing, but the hunting of sense objects that involves killing. And actually all kinds of sense gratification. Prabhupada mentions these things, intoxication, illicit sex, meat eating, gambling, all these things are actually forms of killing, directly and indirectly. They go together. So one perhaps has to understand a little bit about this. If you start with animal killing, Prabhupada mentions one has this philosophy to justify it, that the animals has no soul, or is something like a dead stone. In other words, everybody knows that actually animals have lives of their own. When you say something, here's this kartal. So this is stone, metal, comes from rocks. So this is an object. Dead means it's not alive. There's no soul. But all say, when we say no soul, it means that this stone, this kartal, does not undergo experiences. You see, the difference is, here's my body, which is taking up room in space. It's a material object. And this kartal is a material object that's taking up space. But here, in this object, someone is home. See, I'm undergoing experiences. I have significance for myself. This means that I'm not just an object, but I'm also a subject. Subject means that you're undergoing experiences, you have significance for yourself, you have a life of your own. Whereas in the kartal, this is just an object. It's nobody. No one's there. So it's very easy to see that animals have lives of their own. We all know this. At least when I was a child, we had a family dog, and I had a deep emotional relationship with the dog. You could look at the dog's eye. The dog was happy to see me. The dog was happy. The dog was sad. It was hungry. It felt pain. There was no doubt that there was something. The dog was like me in so many respects, even though it was an animal. Everybody knows this. Well, we don't eat our dogs, but sometimes at home, there are animals that you eat, like rabbits. People eat rabbits. And if you live on a farm, there's chickens and cows and so on. And so everybody, living with these animals, you understand that they have their own lives. If you watch them a little bit, you can see that the chickens in the barnyard, they have politics, they have arguments, they have friends, they have enemies, they have their whole little life is going on. Yeah. And that's all we mean to say, that they're living entities, that they have souls. And Prabhupada put it very simply when he said, what's the difference? We eat, they eat, we sleep, they sleep, we mate, they mate, we defend, they defend. We're of the same category in that sense. So why is this not recognized? It's not recognized because of sense gratification. Because in order to exploit material nature, I have to forget the fact that the living things in material nature have significance for themselves. I have to turn them into things. This is the nature of sense gratification. I take a subject, a living entity who has significance for itself, and in order to be the enjoyer, I turn that subject into an object. In other words, I make it impersonal. So for animal killing, this takes place very obviously. I take the life of this animal. I rob it of its body, and I destroy its life. I interfere with its course of events. If somebody does that to me, that's a terrible crime. That violation of my life, but I do it to the animals and I pretend nothing is happening. And so, as Prabhupada said, it's not that the animal is stone, but we have become stone-hearted. Because what's happened is this nasta prajna, and the previous verse Paranjana described as this is nasta prajna. Prajna means intelligence, and intelligence has been destroyed. So in order to be an exploiter of material nature, we have to make ourselves stupid. We have to pretend. We have to think, oh, nothing is really happening. People go so far as to think that the animals like it. I've seen driving on the road some restaurant which is a big serving steak, you know, beef. And on the front of the restaurant, they have a picture of a cow. And the cow has got the arms up like this and smiling. And the cow has a steak knife in the hands. and you know, some napkin around the neck, like the cow is the eater. Like he's happy. It's very strange. Because, of course, what happens on the real level is that when human beings kill animals, they actually feel guilt. And that's why you see in many civilizations that, just like in the American Indians, they would kill animals. I mean, they were on that hunting stage of life, like forest dwellers and tribal people. They could only live by animal slaughter. Not slaughter, but hunting, anyway. But they would apologize. They would beg forgiveness. They would do some atonement at the same time. They would feel grateful and thankful to the animal for giving them something. And similarly, Prabhupada describes when meat eating is allowed in the Vedas, you have to do something similar. Prabhupada describes that when a goat is offered to Kali at the temple, the ritual is that the person who's sacrificing the goat whispers a mantra into the goat's ear to the effect that I'm going to take your life, and in the future you shall be able to take mine. A So at least on a certain level, people are conscious of this thing, or used to be. But now we've become even more civilized and less conscious. Now simply the modern slaughterhouses, which are simply factories, where there's nothing except just killing. So things become worse and worse. And of course, people then forget more and more what they're doing, and they become more and more greedy. So even if you say somebody needs to kill an animal to stay alive, you would at least limit it to the minimum amount if you have some conscience that I have to do this, please forgive me, and so on. But now there's no sense of that. Let me just have as much as possible. So you've taken living entities, and you do not view them anymore as persons, animals. Also, we do the same thing as plants. Prabhupada, in the temple we have in Dallas, Texas, there was an old tree in the courtyard, and the tree was had grown so that now it was pressing a little against the roof of the building. And gradually this would cause some damage. And so the devotees cut the tree down. And Prabhupada was very angry. And he said, this tree was here long before you were here. Why did you have the right to cut it down? Well, Prabhupada was going to hurt the building. And he didn't care. You know, then you change the building if you have to, but the tree is there first. So this is one of these cases when I became a devotee and first started reading Srimad Bhagavatam in the early days, Bhagavatam was not much available when I first in 1969-70 became in contact with the movement. And somewhere, I think, in 1970, we were publishing it was not the BBT then, it was ISKCON Press, and it was publishing the second canto in a single volume, each chapter a single paperback volume. And the first canto was only available in the books that Prabhupada had printed in India. And you could only read the first canto if you were living in the temple. They weren't being distributed. And in those days, especially in the first canto, Prabhupada teaches that every living entity in the country is a praja, which means citizen. And therefore, the king had the duty to protect all the citizens. The humans were not the only citizens. But the cows, the horses, all the animals, all the plants, they were citizens. And the king had to protect them. So I read this, and I was really astonished at what this meant, because the Bhagavatam always talks about people's duties. Now in the modern world we don't talk about duties so much, but we talk about rights. People have rights. But if you think of what a right means, if to say you have a right, say I want to say I have a right to employment. Somebody considers one of my rights is I have a right to employment. Well, that right just sits there and doesn't do anything unless somebody arranges for me to have a job. So that means if I have a right, that somebody else has a duty toward me. And that's what the Bhagavatam talks about. It talks about the duties of a king. So if it says the duty of a king is to protect all the living entities, that they're all citizens, if you translate that into the modern discussion about rights, this means that every living being has civil rights. Now, when I was reading this in America in 1970, the past 20 years had been the civil rights movement for black people. They didn't have the same rights as white people, and the idea that everyone had civil rights. So that was on my mind, on everybody's mind, this idea of civil rights. And then here Prabhupada is saying, what it amounts to, is that the animals have civil rights. And even the plants have civil rights. So I realized Prabhupada was really radical. He was going to go much further than anybody else and say that. And so this is one of the things, this is one of the examples of something that Prabhupada said in the beginning of the days of the movement that to me just seemed to be so far away from any kind of realization. But you'll notice now that in since then, the last 30 years, there's not only an animal rights movement, but actually, at least in America, there are lawyers who specialize in animal rights. And even it's being taught in law school. They're part of the environmentalist movement, But they want to go to court to protect some endangered species. And so they're trying to make at least a theoretical case that they have some rights like this. And there's even some journal for the legal basis for animal rights. I don't think, as far as I know, these people are talking so much about animal slaughter. They're more on the environmental side, but it would be the same. If it ever gets established that animals have civil rights, we should definitely go to court as the protectors of the cows. and so on. So that's a good sign. I believe that in some ways the Krishna consciousness movement is having an effect in society. At least some section of society is changing. Or at least it seems to be going in opposite directions. On the one hand, the meat eaters and the animal killers are getting worse and worse, but there's another group that becoming vegetarian and animal rights and so on. Both seem to be increasing side by side. So this nasta prajna, you become stupid when you engage in. We can see it with meat eating, how you have to lower your consciousness. In other words, I know, what I really know is what I'm doing to this living entity is a crime. I feel guilt, but I make myself unconscious. So similarly, other kinds of sense gratification are there. Prabhupada talks about young girls in brothels. This is another thing that people haven't come to understand this very well either. We have to say men. They don't think what it is like. How can I go and have sex with some woman? I should think, what is her life like? Is she enjoying this? No, there's somebody who's in economic distress. This is the only way they can make money. And it's not a very pleasant way to make money. to have sex with strange men, sell your body like that, rent your body out for a short amount of time. And of course one discovers that people are in very desperate condition. You know, people have noticed how much the sex trafficking, they call it, where young girls are especially in materially distressed countries are being induced. Oh, you can get a job here, or we give you a job here. Let me take your passport from you. The next thing they know, they're entrapped and so on. And so they're coming out of, you know, Ukraine and Belarus and Central America and Thailand and so on. Like, this is incredible. Traffic is going on. People have finally noticed it and are saying something about it. But there's certainly a market. And any man who does this simply has here's a living human being, but I have to make myself stupid in order to engage in this activity. And of course the woman has to pretend to be having fun. Well, everybody, you should know that this is not fun at all. It's not enjoying it. But they have to put a pretense like this. So it really it's on the same principle of objectifying something, depersonalizing another living being, just so I can enjoy. This is the same process like that. And so this is the basis of modern civilization. Everything is simply here for our exploitation. And when human beings imitate God and try to exploit material nature, we take something alive and turn it into something dead. So you look at what industrial enterprises, what they produce, it just kills off material nature, takes some living place and turns it into concrete and steel and piles of waste. Well, this is what is going on in the world today. So if we are in this consciousness of exploitation and sense gratification, we are not really civilized. There's a nice in the sixth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. Krishna has an interesting, Prabhupada has an interesting discussion in the place where he's answering Krishna's answering this question of Arjuna about what happens if one fails, falls from the path. And the path, he says, is called Brahmanapati, the path of transcendence, Brahmanapati, the path of transcendental realization. So Prabhupada says like this in the purport. He says there are two ways to progress. Those who are materialists have no interest in transcendence. Therefore, they are more interested in material advancement by economic development. That's one idea of progression, right? Material advancement by economic development. Or in promotion to the higher planets by appropriate work. So that's one way to progress. The other, when one takes to the path of transcendence, one has to cease all material activities and sacrifice all forms of so-called material happiness. So that's the two ways like this. And then a little later on, Prabhupada gives an elaborate elaboration of this about he says humanity may be divided into two sections, namely the regulated and the non-regulated. Those who are engaged simply in bestial, like a beast, bestial sense gratifications without knowledge of their next life or spiritual salvation belong to the non-regulated section. And those who follow the principle of prescribed duties in the scriptures are classified amongst the regulated section. The non-regulated section, both civilized and non-civilized, educated and non-educated, strong and weak, are full of animal propensities. Their activities are never auspicious, because while enjoying the animal propensities of eating, sleeping, defending, and mating, they perpetually remain in material existence, which is always miserable. On the other hand, those who are regulated by scriptural injunctions and who thus rise gradually to Krishna consciousness certainly progress in life. And so then he takes the path of progress and divides that into three further sections. The followers of scriptural rules and regulations, but who enjoy material propensities, is following the Karma Kanda division of the Vedas. Those who are trying to find ultimate liberation from material existence, that is the Jnanis. And finally, those who are devotees in Krishna consciousness. Well, these are the and he keeps breaking it down like this, so you can he makes the whole picture of various kinds of human beings. So of course what Prabhupada is what Narada Muni is teaching here is ultimately the path of Krishna consciousness. As far as regulated sense gratification, Prabhupada says in the Bhagavad Gita he puts it this way, even on the royal road, he says, even on the royal road, there is danger of an accident. Royal road meant the highways that the kings used to construct. They were very good highways. Like Autobahn is the royal road. It's the good highway. And so even on the royal road, even on the Autobahn, they're accidents, even though they make it as safe as possible, and so on, like that. The advice is that one should not be attached to the Karma Kanda injunction of the Vedas, because Even the path of regulated sense gratification is dangerous. Because sense gratification is there, then one becomes a little more greedy, a little more greedy, and the next thing you know, you're breaking the principles of scripture. And that's why Narada Muni, again, criticized Vyasadeva, because when Vyasadeva wrote the supplement to the Vedas, he transmitted into Kali Yuga the Karma Kanda instructions for regulated sense gratification. And you remember what Narada Muni said to him. You have given the path of regulated sense gratification, but in time they will forget the regulations and only take this as a license for sense gratification. It's in the Bhagavatam in the first canto. And that's what happens. First, yeah, you can have sense gratification, but under these restrictions. And then people start to find ways of, well, we can forget about this restriction, we can forget about that restriction. Now, the priests do this, actually, because they're like lawyers. They can go into scripture and they can find what do you want to do. I could set up a trade like this. I could have a website. I could make my living in ISKCON with a website, and I'd say, you tell me what you want to do, and I'll get on the database and whatever, and I'll find you the quotes. And I'll supply the arguments that says that actually it's okay. This is possible. So what happened as far as this is one of the things the Vedas allow is restricted animal killing. Animals, if they're killed, must be killed in a sacrifice. And so, as you mentioned, there are many restrictions. When you can do it, how you can do it, what consciousness you have to be in when you do it. But what happened is, in the course of time, is people simply began killing animals more and more, but under the plea of Vedic sacrifice. And the restrictions gradually went away. But because the Vedas allowed sacrifice of animals, animal killing, people said, see, yeah, it's all right, it's in the Vedas. And therefore, Buddha came and denied the authority of the Vedas. That's why he did it, because the Vedas were being put to this use. He said, I don't care for the Vedas. And so that was the emergency measure. So this is the danger of this. And then after that, of course, then Buddha became very successful for a time being. People gave up animal sacrifice, but then animal slaughter. But then there was a whole. To bring back Vedic culture, then Shankaracharya had to come, and to attract the Buddhists back to the Vedas, he had to preach this covered Buddhism, a Mayavad philosophy. Then Ramanujacharya, Madhvacharya had to come and preach the Vaishnava Vedanta, because Shankaracharya, in order to do this, had to twist around the meaning of the Upanishads. So it was a whole big this unregulated animal killing just created such a big problem. So Narada Muni is right. There's this path of restricted sense gratification is also has its dangers. So Prabhupada was very adamant about this. There was a conversation he had, I think part of it's in a book, Science of Self-Realization, where Prabhupada had this conversation with a French cardinal, Danilo. He was very high placed, well, he was a cardinal in the Roman Catholic Church in France. He was close to the Pope. He was very conservative. Almost at that time, there was beginning some idea that priests should not have to be celibate. You could have married priests and so on, but Cardinal Danilo was a strict a traditionalist. So Prabhupada had this interview with him, and Prabhupada started talking about thou shalt not kill. He said to Cardinal Danilo, he says, a meat eater cannot understand God. He was very blunt like this. He said, A meat eater cannot understand God. And of course, Cardinal Danila was trying to argue with Srila Prabhupada, but he wasn't getting anywhere. And at a certain point, he said to Prabhupada, let us go on and discuss higher things. And Prabhupada said, wait a minute, how can we discuss higher things if we don't even understand the basics? And we go right back into this thing about thou shalt not kill. What this meant. So he was very heavy with this cardinal. Of course, Prabhupada is spiritually very perceptive. And when he met this cardinal, you can, I wasn't there for the conversation, but especially if you listen to the tape, you can hear that Prabhupada did not care for this man very much. I mean, sometimes Prabhupada has met people who are Christians and he talks to them a quite different way. And really, much of it depends upon the person. How he is. Even when Prabhupada came to Philadelphia in 75, I arranged for him to meet two professors, one after another. They're both professors. Both of them smoke cigarettes, for example. Both professors of religious studies. And so from an outside angle, actually the one that looked more pious, and there's one that looked less pious to the ordinary observation. But the one of them, Prabhupada blasted him. I mean, it just ripped him to shreds. I mean, the devotees afterwards were so amazed at how heavy Prabhupada was to this person. And to the other guy, he was so sweet and so nice and so merciful, we have to say. And it's just because Prabhupada was just dealing with individual people. So the same with Danilo. You could tell he Prabhupada just really didn't like him. And what happened is the Cardinal Danilo a few years afterwards he died. And it was under unusual circumstances that his body was found in an apartment building outside the apartment of a woman who was a prostitute. So the church had to give some explanation, you know, that yeah, it's true he was on the landing outside of her apartment building, but yeah, this was some fallen soul he was trying to help. But then one of the French newspapers, one of the left-wing anti-Catholic newspapers, they did a little digging, a little research, and they found out that actually this conservative cardinal had been paying regular visits to this lady. She was his mistress. He was among her clients, and that this was a regular affair, and that he had died in her bed during the act of sex. He had a heart attack, got a little too excited in his old age. And that the lady, when suddenly she found a dead cardinal with her, she called wherever he stayed. And so some of the cardinal's aides or assistants came. And to avoid scandal, got him dressed in his clothes and pulled him outside the apartment building, and then they called, notified the authorities that he was dead when he was fully dressed outside the apartment building. So this is what happened. And after we read that, then you could understand, you know, why Prabhupada act was so heavy with his cardinal, because he was just completely hypocritical, and obviously not in any position to understand God. And here he was doing something that's as far as Prabhupada is concerned, is just another hunting process, So these are the things that entangle us in material life. And Prabhupada says that these sinful activities, hunting women, drinking different types of liquor, becoming intoxicated, killing animals, enjoying sex, all serve as the basis of modern civilization. We have to say this is what is a true statement. It's not an exaggeration. And on this basis, so-called progress is taking place. Of course, what will happen is that people will become more and more miserable. This verse described two kinds of unhappy living entities. One kind of unhappy living entities are those who are suffering at the hands of the killers. Those who are suffering at the hands of the killers. And the others who are suffering are those who are called Karunatma, those who are compassionate by nature. They suffer. This is the Vaishnavas, are compassionate by nature. Paradukha Dukhi, this is in a poem by Raghunath Das Goswami describing Sanatana Goswami, that he suffers when he sees that others are suffering. And Prabhupada said this is the characteristic of a Vaishnava. They suffer when they see that others are suffering. But Prabhupada has this rather astonishing statement here. You should notice this. Not only are saintly persons afflicted, that is, suffer, not only are saintly persons afflicted by this killing, but even God himself is afflicted. So, God himself is wants to do something about this, doesn't want to see it happen, is giving pain by this activity. And of course we see with Narada Muni, he's compassionate not only on the animals but also on King Prachinibharishat. He also sees how he will suffer. So he's also trying to help him. We should see this that it said that devotees in the Bhagavatam, Veda Dukatmakan Kaman, devotees know that the soul of all kama is dukkha. The Veda Dukatmakan Kaman, all sense gratification has as its essence suffering, dukkha. It looks like pleasure. In other words, think of candy-coated poison. Well, it looks like candy, will taste good when you put it in the mouth, but in the core, in the center, is poison. That's what sense gratification is. Veda dukatmakan kama. And devotees should know this. We're supposed to know this. And we should see that so many people are just, while they're engaged in their pleasure, are really only gaining suffering The first time Prabhupada saw people on the ocean, on the surfboards riding the waves, you know how they do, surfers. Prabhupada said, "What is that?" They said, "They're surfers, Srila Prabhupada." He'd never heard the word before. He said, "Sufferers?" I told this story once in some lecture at a gathering of some place. I told this story, and some girl said, she said, "I think surfing is a spiritual experience." I said, "How is that?" She says, "You become one with the ocean." I said, "So are the fish." And she saw for a minute, she says, "Yes, you're right." So you become, if you really like it, you become a fish the next night. So that's sufferers. We should see these things. Okay, thank you. Any questions or comments?
How is it that nowadays Buddhists, they are mainly not vegetarians?
Dharma Shaglani. Isn't it Shaglani. Isn't funny? The Buddhists aren't vegetarians. Yes, there's still some. There's still some Buddhists who are vegetarians, but it's the decline of Dharma. I once was talking to a Buddhist, a lady from Thailand who was a professor who taught Buddhism. She was raised in Buddhism. She says that, it's still honored by the fact that on holy days, people don't eat meat. So some memory of it is there, you know. This is what happened. It gradually, one way or another, it starts to get compromised a little bit. I've heard that there was one should not eat meat, but when the monks are out begging, you should eat everything that's put in your begging bowl. So sometimes people would put meat in your begging bowl. And some people really, should we? I guess we should eat it because which rule is best and so on. Anyway, somehow or other, it declined. That's a fact. I mean, if you look at the way the early Buddhas practiced, I mean, they are so austere, and then gradually, the compromises take place. It's very, very tough. Buddhist monastic practices, the Buddhist monks. Funny, isn't it? He came to stop the animal killing, and now, people were shocked to find that the Dalai Lama is a meat eater. Because Tibetan Buddhists are not vegetarian. But most Buddhists aren't, you're right. Anything else? Yes.
Before I had a discussion with the person that was asked where is it stated the four regulative principles, in which place in the shastras, and I couldn't find the answer.
They're stated. I can find it for you. I don't remember. Maybe even in Bhagavatam they're mentioned in Sanskrit. I have it written down somewhere. I was happy to see them in Sanskrit. I'd never seen them. Yeah. they're mentioned somewhere, but I don't know exactly where. Yeah, these things are not made up. Yeah. Of course, you can have so many regular principles. What we do know is regular principles comes in two kinds: what you should do and what you should avoid, yama and niyama. So it's quoted in the Nectar of Devotion. We're discussing all the regular principles. That really, basically, there's two. What you should do is always remember Krishna. That's the injunction, what you should do. And what you shouldn't do, never forget him. Always remember Krishna, that's the do, and the don't is never forget him. And then the verse says, all other rules and regulations are the servants of these two. So one can always judge, does this help me remember Krishna, or does it make me forget him? That's the fundamental pair. Anything else? Yes?
About what?
Surfing. Surfing. Oh, yeah.
One time I was having a conversation with some people who were coming to the temple, and they liked surfing. So they explained to me how it was actually conscious, that because our senses belong to Krishna, and so if we enjoy, he enjoys through us these things. So that Krishna was actually the one enjoying the surfing.
Mm-hmm.
And another reason they gave was that Krishna says that of aquatics is the shark.
That what?
Of aquatics is the shark.
Uh-huh.
So they said that if you're surfing in front of the shark, then you're thinking of the shark. maybe you could explain what was causing that.
Sure. Actually, what he says, among aquatics, I am the makara, which Prabhupada usually translates as shark, but a makara is a Capricorn, you know, the astrological, it's an animal that nobody apparently sees anymore, but the makara has the tail of a fish and the front of a goat or something like that, or sometimes I've seen it has a kind of an elephant's head. That's a makara. That's one. The shark. Yeah, so it says makara-shaped earrings that have this kind of shape. So some people translate it as alligator, and sometimes as shark, but the Sanskrit is the makara, which is in the zodiac. That's Capricorn, that thing. There's an interesting philosophy which is there, that God enjoys by experiencing our enjoyment. This seems to go with a kind of pantheistic impersonalism, really. I wrote a doctoral dissertation on a philosopher that had this idea that. As he says, we are as cells to the cosmos, that God is the cosmic organism, and that somehow or other there's a process by which, well, and this idea that I put something sweet on my tongue, and there's a taste bud which is made of little cells, and the cells enjoy. And then somehow that enjoyment gets passed up through layers of experiences until I'm who I'm at the top of the hierarchy in my body. I enjoy it. So similarly, this is how God enjoys. And by the way, suffers. Like this. So, uh, one can only say that this idea of God is incorrect. He has his own, he does not enjoy through the material energy. God enjoys through the spiritual energy, the internal potency. And so the way he experiences pleasure, which he does experience pleasure, but it's in a different way. And it's not that, what this says is that I enjoy and then I offer the remnants to God. Right? I'm the first enjoyer and God's a kind of parasite on my enjoyment. And of course this not only, you might say, it not only validates surfing, but practically anything you want to do. I mean, as far as a philosophy that says like this, you wonder what is God up to. Like say, there's a cat that kills a mouse. Now God is feeling the feelings of both of them. So the cat, I mean, you look at this experience of a cat killing. Now there's nothing sinful or wrong or bad about a cat killing a mouse. It's an animal and that's its thing, doing what he's supposed to do. So the cat's in a perfect state of bliss and delight. But the mouse is in hell. Now what's that to God, huh? Bittersweet or something? Like I have no idea. It's just anyway. This to me, you know, the idea that somehow or other God's getting something out of all of this is a little rough. So the actual fact is that the devotional process is just the opposite. First, we offer it to God. And then we enjoy the remnants. That's actually what happens. So it's not that I enjoy and then God enjoys after me. It's the other way around. So I have to see what is it that God finds pleasurable and try to serve him. Yeah, he's not like a ghost. You know, a ghost has to clamp onto us and then can try to. Siphon off our feelings. This is the way it works. So that idea tends to be a kind of an impersonalist view and a kind of justification of sense gratification. Certainly, I sit around and smoke marijuana. God gets high. He really likes it. So God has very high level happiness. And the happiness he has is from exchanging of love with the living entities. That's what really sets. We know what he likes. He's told us. That's what he does. If he wants to go surfing, he does it himself. We don't have to do it for him. All sports originate in God, huh? We see some of them anyway. I don't remember surfing anywhere, but well, he does. He's Matsya Avatar. He plays in the waters of devastation. Whatever pleasures a fish has, Krishna does it, right? You can see Balaram and Duvida Gorilla playing like a baseball. He's throwing. So these sports are there also, but mostly Krishna's enjoyment is with the living entities. That's what he's looking for. Swim with the fishes.
Yeah. Tätigkeit nicht mehr. Krishna machen oder das wirklich das Verhalten, wenn wir uns dann abgehört haben, wir machen die Energie, dann wird es machen. Genau.
That's okay. Well, the service is the offering. Yeah. The service itself, what I'm offering to Krishna is the fruits of the work. That is to say, whatever gain is there from this activity, that I do it so that Krishna becomes the enjoyer of it. What I'm doing is satisfying Krishna. The Krishna says, I want this, I want that. And so I do it with that aim that Krishna is the enjoyer. In the Bhagavatam, in the verse Shravanam, Kirtanam, Vishnu, Smaranam, Parasevanam, in the commentary on that verse, Prabhupada distinguishes between devotional service and fruitive work. He says that fruitive workers will do some activity because they want to enjoy the results, but before they enjoy it in a kind of formal or official way, they'll offer something to God. So they do things and they sort of offer it on the side, but their intention is to really be the enjoyer. But he says that devotional service, you surrender to God and do everything for God first. So it's not that, anyway, that he said is the difference in mentality that we should strive for. That everything I do is for Krishna, nothing is for me. And that's what we should learn when we offer prasada. Of course, sometimes it is there, we do this, we want to enjoy something and we make it to enjoy it, and then prayer person. I guess that's better than nothing, but what we should really do, the real mood that we should strive for is, let me make something nice for Krishna. And I don't think about my own satisfaction or sense gratification. And of course, it's possible to do this. It was one of the sort of astounding discoveries that I make, and I guess other people make it too, that on a festival day when you're fasting and hungry, the best way to forget about your hunger is to go in the kitchen and cook. And just cook for Krishna, and the hunger goes away, and all you're thinking about is making a nice preparation for Krishna to enjoy on the festival day. And you don't even think about, when were we going to eat, when we're going to eat. But if you're not in the kitchen cooking, sometimes that thought can be bothering you all the time. When are we going to eat?
So, it's nice practical for me.
Huh?
It's a nice practical for me.
To me, the best way to get through fast days is to cook for Krishna. And you can do it without any attachment to the results. There is some mercy there in that service. Yes. I'm sorry, maybe you could come a little closer, or?
When I feel in my heart some satisfaction or happiness, this means Krishna is enjoying or happy with my activities or my behavior?
Well, maybe and maybe not. First of all, I can see that sometimes I can be doing something that satisfies Krishna, because I know it does, because maybe I've received a direct and unambiguous order by my spiritual master to do something, and I do it. And in the doing of it, there's no particular pleasure or satisfaction in my heart. The only thing is, I know I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing, so there's some satisfaction. But otherwise, I don't feel good. Maybe I'm doing what my spiritual masters told me to do, but it's frustrating. It doesn't work out. It's a struggle. And actually, I feel bad, because it's not working out. Still, I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing. So sometimes there may be no satisfaction in it. And sometimes, on the contrary, there can be some feeling of goodness and satisfaction. And it may be from some other thing. On the other hand, it's true that, as a general rule, there's spiritual satisfaction. And it's of a different quality than material satisfaction. One can recognize that quality. The quality of being pleased because Krishna is pleased. Of feeling happy because Krishna is happy, and sometimes one will feel that kind of happiness, and that kind of happiness has this characteristic: it does not depend upon the course of events; it just will appear. Sometimes you don't know why. What's going on, but one has the sense of this happiness, and it wasn't caused by anything that seems to be going on in the material world. The way to practice experiencing this kind of happiness, since Krishna is usually not available to our senses, is to serve a devotee. When you serve a devotee, you see the devotees are happy, and then you become happy when the devotees are happy. Then you can understand this is spiritual happiness, and we can, this way we can get a taste that quality of pleasure in connection with the devotees. Certainly, it is not that in spiritual life there's no enjoyment. It's all enjoyment. Prabhupada was asked once, in the early days, someone asked him, "Swamiji, what is the meaning of life?" And he said, "The meaning of life is to enjoy." Which, wow, wait a minute, I thought we're not supposed to enjoy. Oh, we are supposed to enjoy. We are made for enjoyment. But we have to educate our desire so that we know how to enjoy. And the way we enjoy is by seeing that Krishna is happy in all respects. That first Krishna enjoys, and then when that happens, then we also become satisfied. So on this, between ourselves and materialists, there's no quarrel. The meaning of life is to enjoy. But from our side, it looks like what they call enjoyment, we call suffering, like the surfers. it looks like it's happiness, but if a devotee sees it with knowledge, he will not see happiness. And Prabhupada always uses this term, so-called happiness. And with a little detachment, when you see people enjoying, you can see them suffering. We say that what their attempt at enjoying is a failure. And we have another understanding of what it means to actually enjoy. That's the difference. So we better, it's getting late now. We better stop. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.